Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Phoned a vote on the wiretapping, some Republican senators are writing their own plan for military tribunals, and today, former Secretary of State Colin Powell joined them in criticizing harsh interrogations. All this, as a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll out today, shows a slight uptick in the president's approval ratings. Well, joining us on the line is the Wall Street Journal's John Harwood. He's also chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. Welcome, as always, John.
Hey, Robin.
And what are the approval numbers, you know, the biggest numbers for the president, and what do you think they mean?
He's at 42% now in this poll, which was conducted just before he gave his 9/11 speech on Monday night. It was completed by the time he gave that speech. That's up from 40% in July, 38% in June. It's not a big bump, and 42% is still a pretty low number for a president, but they'll take any improvement they can get, and so will Republican candidates. The stronger Bush is, the better for them.
Do you think that they are taking those numbers all the way across town in Washington to the Capitol?
Oh, yes. They are hoping that the uptick in the president's support, which occurred among independents slightly and also among Republicans, president's back over 80% with his support among Republicans, that's a pretty good argument to take with Republican members of Congress when he's arguing with them about legislation.
Right.
It's definitely still a daunting election environment for Republicans. In fact, strategists in both parties agree they're going to lose seats. The question is how many and whether or not they can limit the political fallout from all the setbacks he's had on Iraq and other issues. And so the significance of this poll is not that Republicans are on a huge roll or that they're about to win a bunch of seats. It's that maybe the political hurricane they face in November might not be as bad if they can keep up this momentum over the next 8 weeks.
John, the way we understand the debate over the president's plan for military tribunals, the Democrats have sort of stood back and allowed three Republican senators, McCain, Warner, and Graham, to question the president on his plans, for instance, for harsh interrogation. But after his trip to the Hill today, if he's able to forge a compromise with those three senators, what happens then? I mean, does he end up the big winner with Democrats with no defense anymore?
If he can get an agreement with Lindsey Graham, John Warner, and John McCain, that's a big advantage for Republicans, because the last thing Democrats want is a partisan fight on the war on terrorism. They're trying to stick with those Republicans and say, look, people in your own party think you've gone too far, and rely on that to carry the day. If they lose that cover, then Democrats are going to have to either go along with the president, which might alienate their base, or they're going to have to say, oh, okay, we have no choice but to fight on this, and they don't want to fight on it.
Because the perception will be that they, and the Republicans will say that they don't care about national security.
That sets up Democrats to be in the posture of you care more about protecting the rights of terrorists than you do about protecting Americans, and that's not a posture Democrats want to be in the fall campaign.
Right. And John Harwood, before we let you go, one last question. The debate seems to have been, and the presentation of the war in Iraq has been, that the Democrats want to cut and run in the language of the Republicans, and the Republicans want to stay the course. But in fact, that's not true across the board. There are Republicans, especially conservative and fiscally concerned Republicans, who want to leave. And there are Democrats who are of the, we broke it, we have to stay and fix it. So how is that language playing out?
Well, that it was another very interesting result of this poll. Iraq has been the biggest political toothache for Republicans for some time because the war's dragged on. More than 2,500 soldiers have been killed, et cetera, et cetera. It's not been as easy as people thought. And Democrats have been trying to hold Republicans' feet to the fire on that. But what we found in this poll is if the choice is between a Republican who wants to stay there until we secure the country and a Democrat who wants to reduce troop levels, the Democrats got a big advantage. But if the question is a choice between a Republican who wants to stay there and stabilize the country and a Democrat who wants to pull out right now, that's advantage Republican. That is why Republicans from the White House to Capitol Hill are making the argument consistently every single day, they're for cut and run. Even if many Democrats aren't for cut and run as we understand it, that is rhetoric that helps them in the fall campaign.
John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. Thanks so much.
You bet.
There are surprising new claims about teens from relatively affluent families. In a study of families with incomes between $100,000 and $200,000 a year, a prominent researcher found the kids are more troubled than their peers from lower-income families. The researcher is Dr. Sunya Luther. Her studies show that by the time they reach adolescence, more affluent kids are 2 to 3 times more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety, and far more likely to use alcohol and drugs than their lower-income peers. Dr. Luther is professor of psychology and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. She joins us from her home. And Dr. Luther, when we think of at-risk children, we normally think of poorer children. When did you begin to realize that the definition should be widened to include more affluent children and families?
We came upon this population rather by accident, if you will. My career has been studying children in the inner city in harsh urban poverty. And at one point about 10 years ago, I was sitting with my students and wondering whether the trends we'd seen among urban poor kids might generalize at all. So the question was, is this an adolescent phenomenon that we're seeing, or is it an inner city phenomenon we're seeing?
And what were some of the things you were seeing in the inner city that
What we found was that youngsters, adolescents who were popular with their peers at school also tended to be those who were aggressive and sort of broke the rules at school. So it was sort of like admiring kids who bucked the system.
This is in, situations where kids are in poverty.
That's right.
But then?
So having glimpsed this, the question was, is this an inner city phenomenon or an adolescent phenomenon? And it was to address this question that we first went on to look at kids from more affluent families.
And what you did was you had several groups of kids that you compared, in one case, kids to kids in the inner city. Your results seem to be stunning. Is it possible that the kids in the affluent, again, suburban, white-collar homes did have higher uses of cigarettes, alcohol, marijuana, hard drugs than did their inner-city counterparts?
Absolutely. That was the first study we did. And we're seeing the same thing over and over again. If you belong to a family that is well-educated and in the upper-middle classes, the chances of your showing high levels of distress in at least one, if not more, of one of these domains is really quite high.
How do you measure distress, though? Let's do that first, because I can hear someone saying, well, wait a second, if I'm afraid to walk out the door, we have a couple neighborhoods here in Boston having a terrible time, if I'm afraid I'm going to get shot, as opposed to what, I just have some ennui in the suburbs. You know, how do you measure distress?
It's a very good question. When we're talking about ennui in the suburbs, I wish it were quite as trivial as that. What we do is use questionnaires that measure depressive symptoms among kids of that age, or symptoms of anxiety, or problems of delinquent behavior. These are widely used standardized questionnaires. The children tell us, yes, I can't sleep at night, I worry too much, I feel worthless, I have stomach aches all the time. It's getting a count of all of these and adding them together. What we know is what the average American adolescent will tell us. I have, let's say, about 10 of these symptoms. These youngsters are reporting far higher levels.
Yeah. And not only that, when they did use drugs and alcohol to excess, it was to self-medicate, to stem this depression and anxiety they were feeling. And you also found, I thought this was fascinating, that in the affluent, the suburban neighborhoods, the popular kids were the ones who were linked with substance abuse, much as in the inner city neighborhoods, the popular kids were the ones who bucked authority.
And this is particularly true about boys. Boys in these affluent communities who tend to self-report a lot of substance use, cigarettes, alcohol, marijuana, and so on, tend to be among those most admired, seen as the popular cool kids. Youngsters do mess with substances for a variety of reasons. The two big things that have come up in research is one for self-medication, and the other is because it's cool, obviously.
And the problem with that, you point out, is that if you're just doing it to be cool, you could possibly break that,
right.
But in the other case, you might carry it on for life.
What researchers have shown is that this kind of what they call negative affect kind of substance use, the one that's used to self-medicate, tends to endure for longer periods of time over the child's life course.
Hmm. And we should touch on the girls as well, because I thought there was a disturbing finding there as well as to how girls treated other girls.
Well, there's two aspects about the findings on girls. One is that girls' substance use also seems to garner some level of admiration from peers, but there's that interesting double standard that comes in. It also earns them some level of sort of dislike or scorn. In other words, boys are just plain admired. Girls are somewhat admired, but at the same time looked down upon for doing a lot of substances.
And in fact, also, you know, girls being mean to other girls is a big factor.
Right. Probably one of the most troubling findings about girls was actually two things with girls' peer admiration. One was that the girls who were mean to other girls were among those who were considered the most popular or cool. And the other was that popularity of girls was so very heavily linked to their physical attractiveness.
Well, you see that, you know, in the movies, but you like to think it's not as true as your findings say. Well, you then ask the question, why? Why might privileged youth be so troubled? And you presented two possibilities, achievement pressures and isolation from adult. Achievement pressures is what we all think of. They're being told that they have to get into a certain college, they have to have a certain ranking in life. But isolation from adults, what do you mean by that?
There's two kinds of isolation from adults that we examined. One was literal isolation in the sense of being alone home after school. What tends to happen for a lot of us is because the neighborhoods look so sort of safe and manicured and pristine, there is a tendency to assume that our kids are going to be safe after school by themselves.
You write, a common assumption is that parents are more accessible to higher than to low-income kids, but you came up with other results.
Well, our findings do show that a surprisingly large number of youth in these communities are unsupervised at fairly young ages. And these are, in fact, the youngsters that do tend to be getting into the most most trouble.
It's not just unsupervised. I was reading closely when you pointed out that they may be with their parents a lot, but their parents are shuttling them from activity to activity. There's not an intimacy. Tell us about that intimacy with parents. And again, are we going into that area where it almost sounds like parent bashing, you know, that wealthier parents are, you know, not paying attention to their kids? What is it? What was your finding?
Our instinct is to go to the parents and say, what are the parents doing wrong? And I think in the affluent communities, as in any community, when we are troubled or distressed, it's going to show up in our kids as well. But to make the assumption that well-educated, professional parents are somehow, as a group, miserable, I think is wrong-headed. Mm. It's short-sighted. My tendency at this point, having done this work for the last 10 years, is to think a little more broadly and go beyond the family into the wider culture and see what exactly is going on.
And what is that, do you think?
Well, let's start with the American dream, which tells us that the route to happiness is material success. This is something that is advertised widely all over. It's ubiquitous in our culture. And the corollary to that is, if you want material success, you'd better get into a very, very selective school, a college. This is something that is so hard for people not to buy into. And essentially what I'm beginning to sense is a feeling among parents and the children, if I can, then I should. What I mean by that is, if I have the ability, the intellect, the opportunity to get into that higher echelon, then that is what I must at all costs aspire toward.
Dr. Sunia Luther of Columbia University, on her study of affluent teens, she says she found they were as troubled as their less affluent peers. We're going to take a break. When we come back, role of parents. Well, Dr. Luther, you also make another interesting connection. You say kids who are unwell psychologically grow up to be people who acquire things rather than being giving adults. And, of course, the kids we're talking about are the kids who might have the means to be giving.
Well, people have asked me, so why bother? Why should we care? And my response is, look, even if we don't care about the children themselves, and I strongly believe we need to, no child deserves to be unhappy regardless of what his or her parents earn or how much they've studied. Even if you don't care about the children's happiness, let's stop and think. Many of these youngsters are going to be the leaders of tomorrow. Fact number one. Fact number two, we know that when people are depressed or feeling poorly psychologically, they tend to be more acquisitive rather than generous or philanthropic.
You make, in effect, some recommendations in the report. One of them is as simple as having dinner with children to forge that intimacy that they may not have because their parents are too busy. But another would obviously be to get kids some help if they're severely depressed. But why is that more of a problem in the affluent community than, let's say, the low income?
Affluent parents are sometimes more reluctant to seek help in psychotherapy and so on, partly because they're much more concerned about the privacy of their family's problems. Many of us struggle against this feeling of, I should be able to do it better than most other people. And so that privacy is a big factor. The other issue is they don't want it on their children's school records that there's any kind of emotional problem. But I think you talked about having dinner as being an important issue. Yes, our research has shown that's important at pre-adolescence with younger children and so on. I do think as we're getting into the older age groups, there's so much that depends on the mental health of the parents and more specifically the mothers. As long as the mothers are hurting, it is going to be very difficult for us as a group to be able to shepherd our children through this very sort of tumultuous time of adolescence.
Why are mothers hurting?
I think as a group, we mothers are faced with an impossible set of choices. On the one hand, many of us have worked very hard through school and college and higher education, and I'm then faced with these choices of either you work at a career and then worry about your children being alone at home or having substandard care, or you give up your career and stay home. Very, very difficult choices. I have worked with suburban communities now for the last 10 years, and I talk to parent groups very regularly. Through the course of my talks, one question that I almost always bring up is, you know, we've talked about the kids so much. Let's talk about us for a second. How much do we as moms feel taken care of, feel psychologically robust, feel fed? And there's inevitably an uneasy silence in the room. The reality is that as mothers, we tend to put everything in the family, the routines, the schedules, everybody else's needs first. And what ends up happening for too many women, too many mothers, is there's very little left at the end of the day for us.
Dr. Sunia Luther, professor of psychology and education at Teachers College, Columbia University, who has done the study on the problems of affluent kids. And Dr. Luther, you mentioned briefly, you know, these are kids we know. These are suburban kids. These are, you know, not just the children of Hollywood or something, but they're also your kids. Share some thoughts with us. What would you, as a researcher, want to keep an eye out for in your kids?
A big thing I'd watch out for is substance use among the boys. And the tendency of these young boys to gather in the playground in the evening with a bottle of Poland Springs filled with vodka, for example.
Mm. And how would you know if your child was depressed? I mean, you know, how many teenagers mope around and say, I'm bored? That's not depression. What is?
For any mother to suspect that her child is really depressed and troubled is very, very difficult. And if we have some kind of inkling, look, something doesn't seem right with my daughter or my son, what I urge parents to do is push that inkling, just go talk to them. Yes, they will roll their eyes and say, get off my back, Mom. But if that is your instinct, talk to them and be assured. If you're still not assured after talking to them, well, get some help and make sure you have them professionally evaluated. But don't be too quick to assume, because my child is a class captain or the best athlete in the school and is getting terrific grades and is popular, that the child is happy as well.
As your research shows, the popular kid might be the one with the worst substance abuse problem.
Absolutely. Well, my son was actually talking about how the kids who sometimes are the most academically successful are the ones who are drinking the most, even.
Dr. Luther, by the way, where are the affluent kids now that you studied?
Well, we've been doing this longitudinal study with these youngsters. We started when they were in the sixth grade, and they are now going to be sophomores in college. And we've been following them. I have to say that I am personally deeply indebted to these youngsters, and the field of child development as a whole, I think, will be too, given the courage and the generosity with which they have shared their experiences with us over these years.
Dr. Luther, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Sunia Luther, professor of psychology and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. Well, we have this brief note on a story that's raising questions about the role of the media. A woman who said her 2-year-old toddler was abducted from his crib has killed herself, according to Florida authorities. According to her family, 21-year-old Melinda Duckett shot herself after she was grilled by CNN host Nancy Grace. Here's a portion of that interview beginning with Grace.
Where were you? Why aren't you telling us where you were that day? You were the last person to be seen with him.
And we've already gone out and distributed the flyers and spoken.
Right. Why aren't you telling us and giving us a clear picture where you were before your son was kidnapped?
Because I'm not going to put those kind of details out.
Why?
Because I was told not to.
Miss Duckett, you're not telling us for a reason. What is the reason? You refuse to give even the simplest facts of where you were with your son before he went missing. It is day 12.
With all media. It's not just there, just with all media, period.
Melinda Duckett, whose son Trenton disappeared 2 weeks ago, being questioned by former prosecutor turned talk show host Nancy Grace on CNN. Police have not said Duckett is a suspect in the case. That harsh interview has sparked an outcry from Duckett's family and in internet chat rooms. Melinda Duckett committed suicide a day after the taping. That night, the interview was aired. Grace says it's a sad development, but they will continue to cover the story. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K to 12 nationwide, mos.org/nctl. And Pegasystems, offering smart business process management software, driving business agility for growth, productivity, and compliance, online at pega.com.
Turkish Penal Code, which punishes the public denigration of Turkishness with up to 3 years in prison. Her trial date is set for 1 week from today, the same day she's due to deliver her baby. Elif Shafak splits her time between Tucson, Arizona, where she teaches at the University of Arizona, and Istanbul, where she is today on a rather scratchy cell phone line, but still welcome, Elif.
Thank you very much.
Well, there are several passages apparently in your book that these nationalist lawyers found offensive. I've got one in front of me. It's an Armenian man worried about his niece being brought up by a Turkish stepfather. And he says of her, "What will that innocent lamb tell her friends when she grows up? Will she say, I am the grandchild of genocide survivors who lost all their relatives to the hands of Turkish butchers in 1915? But I myself have been brainwashed to deny the genocide because I was raised by some Turk named Mustafa." That would, I would imagine, incense anyone who would feel it would be insulting Turkishness to say there was a genocide.
Yes, that paragraph was thought to be, it was found dangerous by these nationalists. Lawyer who sued me. In my book, I tell the story of a Turkish Muslim family and an Armenian American family. At the first glance, they're so different, but they do have a common past and a sad past. I tell their stories through the eyes of women, especially Turkish women and Armenian women. There are multiple voices in the book, multiple characters. Some of the Armenian characters in the book have a bad opinion, have a negative opinion regarding Turks. So I voice all these different opinions.
You know, it's interesting. The book was originally written in English. It sold 60,000
yes.
copies. That's a bestseller there. What do you think it says about people in Turkey that they're snapping it up, even though it, you know, goes against the government's decree?
Ever since the day it came out, it has been a bestseller in Turkey. It has been read, circulated, and discussed freely and widely. But I think after 2 or 3 months of such, you know, wide and well reception, it was a backlash. In other words, the fact that this trial is taking place is not the sign that nothing is changing Turkey. I think it's just the opposite. It's precisely because things are changing in this country and in a positive, progressive direction that these nationalists have panicked so much. Therefore, their backlash is louder.
You're saying the nationalist lawyers are producing this backlash maybe in the hopes of putting the brakes on change. And as we mentioned, all of this is being watched closely by the European Union. They release a report on October 24th rating Turkey's progress in reforms to bring the country in line with EU laws so that it can join the European Union. That report is expected to criticize the political record in Turkey currently, including the record on freedom of speech. So are you saying that this move to bring you to court because of something you've written might be a part of that sort of trying to keep Turkey from joining the European Union?
Absolutely. That is my impression. That's my opinion. There's a clash of opinions in this country. Like in many other countries, I believe there's a clash of opinions going on. On the one hand are the ones that do support Turkey's EU membership and that do want to make Turkey a much more open society, a society that has come to grips with its past, that has that is more in harmony with its cosmopolitan heritage, much more open and tolerant. On the other hand, are the ones that want to keep this society as a xenophobic, insular, isolated nation state. And those are the ones that are playing this very dangerous and dirty game of the politics of fear.
Elif, I just want to mention that Turkey's best-known novelist, Orhan Pamuk, was also indicted last year for telling a Swiss newspaper that over a million Armenian and 30,000 Kurds were killed in these lands. That was his quote. But the charges were dropped against him. Nobody's ever been jailed on this for this crime of insulting Turkishness. And as we said, you're expecting a baby on the same day you're supposed to go to trial. What are you going to do? What are you anticipating?
As you said, until today, nobody has been directly imprisoned because of Article 301. The thing is, when there's a negative verdict at the end of the court process, what usually happens is this. That penalty is postponed, provided you do not repeat the same crime for the next 5 years. In other words, Article 301 is a very powerful political weapon, or a legal weapon, I should say, to silence people, because next time you write on a similar issue, you would have to think twice. So they do not take you to prison directly, but they do silence you.
Well, and will you abide by that if that happens to you?
I mean, when I'm writing fiction, I do not hold myself back. My writing matters so much to me, so I don't think I will be able to hold myself back, even if there's a negative outcome at the end of this trial.
Elif Shafak, she faces up to 3 years in prison in Turkey for insulting Turkishness by mentioning the Armenian genocide and other things in her novel, The Bastard of Istanbul. Elif, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And a couple of news notes. Holocaust survivor and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Elie Wiesel says Iran should be expelled from the UN. In a telephone interview today with Associated Press, Wiesel says he wants Iran expelled and its president declared persona non grata because the president threatens a current member, Israel, with destruction. Iran announced April 11th that it had enriched a small quantity of uranium, fueling international concerns that it's well on its way to developing an atomic bomb. But the country insists its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes only. And on a much lighter note, a Starbucks customer in New York City is feeling bitter about the coffee giant that's on every block. She's angry with Starbucks because the company pulled a free drink offer that was supposed to be for employees only. She's suing for $114 million, the cost, she says, of free drinks for all of those who, like her, were turned away. Starbucks originally emailed the offer to its employees in the Southeast, asking them to forward it to family and friends of employees, but things quickly got out of hand when the emails were forwarded to millions of people across the country and posted online. If you have one, the company says if you don't work there, it's not worth anything. Legal experts say the customer stands on shaky legal grounds. Well, still to come, she's not one to shy away from tough topics. On stage, we meet choreographer Liz Lerman, who takes on genetic research in her new dance piece. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, a moment now for some of your emails and a correction of our own. Last week, talking to a New Orleans filmmaker about a local community activist, I said one of the stupider things I've ever said.
Created a community center for young African-American kids, and it's called the Marcus Garvey Community Center.
After the athlete.
What? Marcus Garvey was the Jamaican-born black nationalist who in the early 1900s advocated self-reliance and determination for African-Americans and launched the Back to Africa movement.
Marcus Garvey, the athlete? What was I thinking? I'll tell you in a moment, but your emails came fast and thankfully not furious. Steve Follinsby writes, "You think that big pappy David Ortiz of the Red Sox is great? You should have seen that, Marcus Garvey." Katrina from the Mason City, Iowa Public Library writes, "Marcus Garvey, an athlete? We're librarians, so that made our ears perk up and go all pointy. We were just curious, what team might he have played on?" Another listener asked if maybe I conflated Marcus Allen, the football great, with Steve Garvey, the baseball player. No. It turns out we discovered that several of us here were convinced there was an athlete named after icon Marcus Garvey. Yes, we were sure he'd had a playground named after him or something. Wrong again. The Marcus Garvey Park in Harlem is named after the one and only Marcus Garvey we can find, the 20th century black nationalist. When I explained that to Katrina the librarian, she wrote back, "That's okay. I once mixed up Edgar Rice Burroughs, creator of Tarzan, with heroin-addled beat author William S. Burroughs," adding, "I still think that would have been one heck of a book." Well, speaking of emails, we received one recently from our colleague Dan Grossman, the freelance environmental radio producer. You've often heard him on Here and Now from an ice cap in Greenland or Peru. Well, he was writing to say he couldn't make a meeting about an upcoming project because he had to go to court to protest a ticket he received for backing up trying to save a turtle. Say what? Well, of course, we wanted to know more, so we invited Dan in. Dan, what happened? You were driving down a highway in New Hampshire?
Well, I was driving down the highway, and I saw a turtle crossing the road out of the corner of my eye, and it was halfway across the side of the highway that I was traveling on, headed toward the other side of the highway. So I pulled over to the breakdown lane, and then I backed up to try to catch this turtle before it got run over. Backed up about an eighth of a mile or so to where I thought it was.
Well, that's a long way.
Yeah, it is kind of a long way. Actually, my wife was screaming at me. She was saying that it was dangerous. And then I noticed that a police car had pulled up right behind me. He got out of the car, came over, asked me what I was doing. I said, well, there was a turtle in the road and I wanted to save him. And he basically didn't wash.
How much was the ticket?
The ticket was $150.
Oh, boy, that's a lot.
Well, actually, it's much worse than that. I just talked to my insurance agent. This is going to cost me $500 in increased insurance over the next 6 years.
For the turtle. What happened to the turtle? Did you get him?
Well, at that point, I didn't feel like I really could pay any more attention to the turtle. I was already in enough trouble, and so I never found out what happened to it. I just took off.
But you did find out that this is a big problem for turtles being squished on roads.
Well, yes. I came across one interesting piece of information. Someone had estimated that there were 15 turtles that got squished in Maine. Now, those are the ones that were reported to the highway department.
But, Dan, I mean, first of all, if you drive around New England at certain times of year, you see big signs, you know, careful turtle crossing. But you were on a big highway, and we understand there was an accident when another driver tried to do what you did. So how are you going to appeal this ticket? What case are you going to make?
Well, you know, I'm not a lawyer. There is something in U.S. Jurisprudence called the necessity defense. Basically, yes, you broke the law, but there was some greater purpose in that. And I agree that I backed up. I shouldn't have backed up. I would never encourage anybody else to do that. On the other hand, it seems like the punishment doesn't fit the crime. I was not only trying to save the turtle, but there are many accidents that are caused when people swerve out of the way of turtles. And so, in fact, it could have been helpful to prevent an accident by picking up the turtle and bringing it across the road.
Dan, we can't help but love you for your passion, but I wish you luck, buddy. I don't think it's going to fly. Dan Grossman, independent radio producer, fighting his traffic ticket. Next time we talk to him, we'll be talking about trying to save polar ice caps.
It's always going to have to do with saving something.
Dan, thanks. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now.
Look at that turtle go, bro.
On a faraway island of Solomon, I sent a year of the turtle to was a king of the pond. A nice little pond, it was clean, it was neat. The water was warm, there was a plenty to eat.
Duke University in North Carolina tonight and tomorrow. It premiered at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, where Here and Now's Lynn Menegon caught up with a guest performer in the piece, Suzanne Richard. She has a personal take on genetics.
I have osteogenesis imperfecta, which is brittle bones disease, which is actually a genetic mutation. It's only a mutation because no one in my family is a carrier except me now. So it was a spontaneous mutation. And I was actually my own eighth grade science project to find out why I wasn't growing. I've had many, many broken bones, and mostly when I was younger. So I think growth was stopped every time I would break something. I had like 60 broken bones growing up. So growth would stop every time I broke, and so I just ended up a lot shorter than everybody else.
And you dance with crutches, mm-hmm. and you do some amazing things with them. You can move quickly across the stage. You can make sound with them in a way that none of the other dancers can do. You can leap through the air in surprising ways with them.
When I was little, I really wanted to be a dancer, but I had enough presence of mind to realize that, well, first of all, I couldn't get into any of the ballet classes. So I was pretty sure I wasn't going to be a dancer, so I went into theater. And I'm an actor professionally, and it's actually nice because I rarely play people with disabilities, so it's kind of fun to be representing my peeps. And I'm playing the wild genome. I don't know really what it is exactly.
The wild genome. You are the floating unknown kind of figure, or?
More of the mutation, the difference. We call it Apple.
I wanted people in their seats to have to think, well, should those dancers be able to take that kind of movement and dance with that? I mean, is that like okay?
That's choreographer Liz Lerman. She uses apples on stage to symbolize her concerns about genetic manipulation. Why? Partly because she partnered with the Mott family's Applewood Heritage Farm in Flint, Michigan, where scientists are trying to preserve 25 different kinds of rare apples.
I mean, once there were thousands and thousands of kinds of apples. And now, partly because we want apples at certain times of the year, and because we like red apples. We had something to do with it. We picked the red apples, and there are not so many brown apples anymore.
What physically happens on stage? Do you bring apples on stage? Do dancers roll them, throw them, eat them?
Let's see, in that section, there's a variety of movement. Some of it's like traveling, because the apples traveled from Kazakhstan. That was where apples began, and they actually took the Silk Road. So you kind of have a sense of like a journeying and a traveling. And if you cut an apple in half and you look at the core, you have those five carpels, the seeds. And there's a beautiful video of that, and then that transmorphs into five people in the place of the seeds. And they're all very diverse. And then as the dance proceeds, they become more and more until it's just one. Until it's just one person in the apple, in the five parts. And then that apple gets multiplied thousands of times on the screen, so you suddenly see like a kaleidoscope of the same person. It's very, very beautiful. And I like the fact that it's so beautiful, but I hope you're also wondering, well, what we gave up for that beauty.
Lerman didn't just involve apple researchers. She also spoke with hundreds of genetic scientists around the country and even included them in the piece on videotape.
You could start out by just laying dancers out end to end on the floor, head to foot, head to foot, head to foot.
One section is called Scientist as Choreographer. We asked the scientists to pretend that they were the choreographer and to take one of their processes and explain it in choreographic terms.
It's the genome shuffle, okay?
So if the dancers were going to do this hormone drift...
And then they would stir themselves and different groupings would occur.
It's really funny. So they're trying to explain, let's say they want to explain how a DNA replicates.
But the chromosomes are basically all the same. You can just take them and go back, and it's just a matter of shuffling, rearranging the pieces. You got it?
Turns out many scientists think that dance is an absolutely appropriate mechanism for an expression of what they're trying to do.
You wouldn't think that. How an idea, an abstract idea, can become physical. So, how can you do that?
Well, initially, my first take on that was that the biological processes themselves are so physical. They're tiny, so we don't think of them as physical. But one of the scientists I met from the University of Chicago was all excited because they had just hired a new geneticist, and his field was traffic patterns in a cell. And that's right. There's so much packed into these cells. That's why the dance starts with a woman with a telescope looking out. And then she turns the telescope in on her body. And that's when the stars come out. Because one of the first things I gathered as I started thinking about this is that the scale internally is just as cosmic as what we consider the universe. It's very hard to imagine. And in fact, one reason why the scientists, I think, like dancers is they themselves are trying to visualize. It's all so small.
We're all very similar.
Head to foot, head to foot.
Ferocious Beauty Genome is a complex piece. Even Gregor Mendel makes an appearance on stage. Remember him from school? Liz Lerman does. He's the 19th century German monk and genetics pioneer who experimented with the genes of pea plants.
First, I was drawn to Mendel because he's my first memory. Secondly, I'm drawn to him because he died without knowing that his work was appreciated. And as an artist, I've always been thoughtful about that people who spend their whole lives, you know, obsessing and working on something and never know that it had an impact. And actually, when I got the MacArthur, I have to say that the most amazing thing about that was to feel like in my own lifetime somebody said, your work matters. It was a big shock about that. And in some ways, I think that's why I'm drawn back to somebody like Mendel. Also, he was so incredibly obsessive. I mean, singular, counting 19,000 peas or this, you know. And lastly, and maybe most importantly, because he's a monk. And although I think there are reasons for religion and science to be separate, and they do very different things, and I think each is very, very powerful in its own right, I think it's interesting to look for where these things can be really, really compatible. And they were very compatible in him. And I think it's important for people to understand that. It doesn't have to be. You don't have to automatically set up that religion and science will be in contradiction with each other. And I think that's a really unhealthy place for us to get to. And we seem very caught in that right now. I feel like spend the night with a show like this, and you'll be stretching your muscles to help you be the kind of person I really think we need right now, which are people who are willing to interpret and reinterpret and reinterpret what's happening to us, and then I hope take some action. So it isn't so much that I want people to walk out and say, gee, I better write my congressman about genetics. It's not that. But I would love people to walk out and say, wow, I have so much to think about, and I can feel and think at the same time. I don't have to compartmentalize these things.
Here Now's Lynn Manigan produced our piece on Ferocious Beauty Genome. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Did 9/11 make editors reluctant to take reporters' stories about torture and other U.S. missteps in war? Also, Chris Smither, he found the blues in New Orleans and shared it with singers like Bonnie Raitt. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.